Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us, that is to say LGBT people, but they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
It might surprise you to learn, as assumed as evolution is in the culture, in education, even in the way that we Christians think, we tend to think in evolutionary terms because that's the way we've been taught to think. We have to consciously force ourselves not to accept the presuppositions of evolution if we're going to be consistent with Holy Scripture. It might surprise you to learn that the popular so-called proofs for evolution are not proofs, and believe it or not, many who still advocate for evolution, for Darwinism, the classic model of the origin of all life from simpler to more complex creatures, they don't buy the proofs either. They know that they're not true. They allow them to remain in textbooks nonetheless. We're going to talk about some of the falsehoods of evolution on this Tuesday afternoon, June the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. This is Issues Etc. coming to you live. Pastor Joshua Schneider will join us for the first half hour of the program. After that, Pastor Hans Feeney joins us. We're going to talk about pastors, youth, and forgiveness. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will be our guest from the Ruth Institute. We'll talk about the impact of fathers on culture. Father's Day is coming up in a couple weeks. And then Dr. Joel Bierman will join us. There was a recent New York Times column called Religion and Sex Quiz. It is a very popular quiz from a popular book on religion and sex. I'm interested in whether or not the conclusions of that quiz, the answers to that quiz given by the columnist for the New York Times, bear any resemblance to the truth about what the Bible teaches regarding various matters on human sexuality. Dr. Joel Bierman will be our guest. Now, you can join us for the next 2 hours of the program, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. You can send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or leave your thoughts and comments on the New York Times Religion and Sex Quiz at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Pastor Joshua Schneider is pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Kahului, Hawaii. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Deconstructing Evolution's Icons. Pastor Schneider, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be on the show.
We're accustomed to seeing diagrams, long paragraphs in biology textbooks that purport to prove that evolution is true. They're presented as fact. You say that even the advocates of evolution don't buy these proofs. They know that they have been proven bogus. What's going on?
Yes, well, many of the commonly cited textbook evidences for evolution have even been discarded by the scientific community, but they persist in a lot of textbooks because they're kind of perceived as useful teaching tools to promote evolution, or that, you know, in some way they present good examples of evolution. But in reality, many of them have already been discarded as not really relevant to proving the greater theory of evolution.
You say that often the so-called proof for evolution amounts to just accepting what everybody says. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the scientific community is, you know, widely controlled, and the media widely controlled by those who are promoting evolution, and they present it as a debate against science versus religion, and that religion and people holding a religious viewpoint don't have a place within the discussion because there's got to be a strict separation of religion and science. So it's kind of a priori or kind of before the fact ruled out of the discussion that you could consider any alternatives to simply naturalistic or materialistic cause for life.
It's almost, I mentioned this before, but it's almost reached the point where Christians who reject the presuppositions of evolution have to consciously think in other terms because those presuppositions so permeate the way that we that everybody thinks here. Are we losing the battle for the Christian mind on this subject?
I'm not sure I followed it. You're saying, could you restate that, I guess?
Well, my own personal experience is, Pastor Schneider, that I find evolutionary presuppositions kind of worming their way into the way that I think, even though I reject the theory entirely. Yeah. It just seems to be the fabric of how we think about the origin of life or about the animal kingdom that we live in. Do you think we're losing the battle for the Christian mind little by little because the presuppositions are often accepted without any examination at all?
Yeah, I think a lot of people accept it uncritically just because they hear scientists and TV programs that promote the idea as established fact, and it's just routinely heard from, you know, from even little children's books all the way up to, you know, high school and college textbooks. It's just kind of presented as an accepted fact, and there's never really any discussion of the controversy that exists even in the science community over those things. And there's even, you know, an alternative worldview that might better explain that scientific evidence. So I think that people, in some ways, you know, we are losing the battle in the sense that if people just accept it uncritically, but I think there's really a wealth of resources and information out there, especially today, that is starting to kind of undermine those foundation or pillars of evolution and show that that the theory doesn't really give the best explanation of the evidence.
Let's go through a couple examples of so-called proofs for evolution, beginning with one that you say is still found in many textbooks, the picture or diagrams depicting human embryonic development. What is it?
Right, yeah. When I was a biology major at Concordia University River Forest, one of the general biology textbooks that we had still contained these pictures of Haeckel's embryo diagrams. And Ernst Haeckel was a German scientist who proposed a theory that during the embryonic development in the womb, that organisms kind of relived their evolutionary history so that if you were given a window inside what was happening in the stages of development in the womb, that you could see the organism kind of reliving its evolutionary history. And so he compared various different types of animals, like maybe a lizard, a bird, a fish, and a human, and showed pictures of how in that early stages of development inside the womb that they looked very similar and had very similar features. And so this kind of lent evidence to the fact that they had a common ancestry, that they had evolved from each other, and it was just kind of that the organism is retracing its ancestry when it goes through those stages of development.
Well, first let's deal with kind of the way it's presented. What's wrong with, before we get to the theory, which is kind of bizarre, what's wrong with the depictions of the human embryo at various stages of development and comparing it with the alleged evolutionary chain?
Well, one of the biggest problems is that it's well known, even in the evolutionary community, an example, a well-known evolutionist who's now deceased, Stephen Jay Gould, you know, said that these really had no use or value in evolutionary discussion any longer. They've been widely discredited that he actually, that the drawings were fraudulent, that they were not accurate depictions, and that he sort of picked and chose stages that, you know, appeared to be most similar to one another. So he didn't, you know, necessarily match them up in the actual sequence, you know, in the same sequence that they actually developed. And the author of the book, author of the book, The Icons of Evolution, Dr. Jonathan Wells, points out that he actually completely skipped over the very earliest stages of development, which are the stages where there's the greatest differences between the different organisms. And the theory is kind of put forward to say that that should be where the greatest similarities are, but actually those prove to be the most dissimilar. And that part of the evidence is completely left out of the picture.
We're talking with Pastor Joshua Schneider, pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Kahului, Hawaii. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Deconstructing Evolution's Icons. It's Tuesday afternoon, June the 7th. You're listening to Issues, Etc. When we come back, another 10 minutes with Pastor Schneider. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can send us an email with a question or comment on debunking some of the so-called proofs of evolution on this Tuesday afternoon. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. Or if you visit our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, you can leave a question or comment. For the second hour of the program, we talk with Dr. Joel Bierman of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis about a recent religion and sex quiz written by a New York Times columnist. Some very interesting answers given there, alleging what is and isn't taught in the Bible about human sexuality. When we come back, some more examples of alleged proofs of evolution debunked.
The Concordia Catechetical Academy presents its annual symposium on catechesis in Waukesha, Wisconsin, June 15th through the 17th. This year's theme, the third article of the Creed, the person and work of the Holy Spirit. Pastors Peter Bender, Christopher Esquette, Peter Scare, Rick Stuckwish, and Dean Taylor make presentations on private confession and absolution, Jesus' catechesis on the Holy Spirit, and what it means to confess one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Register online at peacesussex.org.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana, Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee, and Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues, Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues, Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about falsehoods of evolution, often presented as proofs of evolution. Pastor Joshua Schneider is our guest. Mike is listening in Kansas City. Mike, thanks for waiting on the line. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Pastor. I wish people listening would consider supporting Issues, et cetera. It's a great resource. And thanks again for the topic. My question has to do with something I've heard concerning that famous picture of apes progressing into a man. You know, there's about six or seven different silhouettes there. It's just plastered everywhere. My understanding is that most scholarly evolutionists, quote-unquote scholarly evolutionists, don't say that we actually evolved from an ape. What they say is there was a genetic fork in the road long before apes came on the scene. So my point is that isn't that really disingenuous of them to, on one hand, say that we do not evolve from apes, there was a genetic fork in the road before apes arrived, and at the same time they still continue to use these diagrams?
Mike, thank you very much. Thanks for listening in Kansas City. Pastor Schneider.
Yeah, I think that's his description is accurate there, and good point. The according to their account of human evolution, he's right that supposedly we're not, that apes aren't directly in our own ancestry, but they are on a separate fork, and that there would be some common branch or, like you said, the fork in the road where our common ancestor would be found. And of course, that's the problem: is where are the fossils? Where are the evidences of those common ancestors between apes and humans? And kind of building a sequence to show that evolution. And they fill it in with a lot of artwork and, kind of creative representation, but that artwork, really stretches the fossil evidence a lot further than it can go.
You mentioned something before the break I find intriguing. You said that one of the proofs, that is the depiction of human embryology as proof of evolution, is an example of the scholar choosing evidence, kind of cherry-picking facts and putting them in the order that best suited what he wanted to prove. Is this true of a lot of alleged proofs of evolution?
Yeah, I think a lot of times they just present the some kind of glamorous images that seem to really show the proof of evolution. Another example is kind of the horse sequence. A lot of textbooks also have this chain of some, small, almost dog-like creature, and then going through various stages up into a modern type of horse, and various intermediates along the way. And the problem is that that's another discredited example, curator of one of the natural history museums, I think his name is Colin Patterson, said that at Darwin's time, that was one of the key proofs of evolution, fossil proofs of evolution that was held up, and Darwin kind of anticipated that for his theory to be proved, there would have to be a lot more discoveries of similar examples like that. And Patterson pointed out that that one has now been removed as one of the key evidences because they found that sequence doesn't really occur and that they were kind of artificially put into that sequence, not that it was actually found in successive layers, that these were all kind of followed in a nice progression, but they were mixed and put together from various places.
Now, another proof that dates from Darwin's time are Darwin's finches. What is this, and why does it fail to meet the level of proof for evolution?
Yes, that's probably one of the most commonly cited proofs of evolution is the changing of various finch populations in the Galapagos Islands, which is where Darwin traveled on his voyage on the Beagle and kind of started to formulate some of his ideas about evolution, and he saw the diversity of the animals there, and that certain finch populations, when there was droughts or other things, the size of their beak would change, maybe from a smaller beak to a thicker, stronger beak that would be able to crack, dry nut casings and to get at seeds to feed themselves, and that there were various different designs of, kind of more narrow beaks that could drink nectar and so on like that, and that this small, changes of beak sizes was to help adapt them to their environment so that they could better survive in their own environment.
Why does it fail as a proof?
Because they argue that those small changes over a long time could accumulate and lead to larger changes into new, fundamentally different types of birds or organisms. But the problem is that having the benefit of many more generations of observation, they find that these changes are cyclical. In other words, they go back and forth. So a finch population might start out with a smaller beak, but then during a period of drought, the population grows thicker beaks, and it seems to be making some kind of evolutionary progress. But then, when the rains return and feeding conditions are better, the population returns back to its normal beak size. And so, kind of this oscillating back and forth doesn't provide any net evolution. It doesn't head in any particular direction. It's just kind of changing back and forth, and it doesn't give kind of the accumulating kind of climbing up the evolutionary ladder. It's just kind of horizontal movement, not vertical movement.
The final example that you deal with really strikes at the heart of a lot of evolutionary proofs as well, in that you say it supposes, or evolution supposes, there's going to be an increase or a greater complexity over time of genetic information, but the proof is actually the opposite, found in one of the things we often hear about, antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They change, they survive, and they become resistant to bacteria. Why doesn't it serve as a proof?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, the theory of evolution, starts with the idea that all life descended from, single-celled organism and gradually proceeded upward to more and more complex forms of life. And in order to have that happen, there has to be some kind of engine that's creating new information and moving vertically up that evolutionary ladder. And the example that's usually provided by evolutionists as what that engine would be is mutations, and that mutations can supply the needed genetic changes to add new information and to make beneficial changes to organisms that would allow them to kind of move slowly up that evolutionary ladder. But the problem is that when mutations happen, there is such a thing as a beneficial mutation, but there aren't examples of mutations that actually increase information. And just to kind of explain what I mean by that is that there are, for example, bacteria that can develop mutations that enable them to survive against certain antibiotics, like penicillin, for example. And so that mutation that makes them resistant to penicillin is a beneficial mutation. But when you actually study the genetics of it, they say that it might be through kind of breaking down a normal pathway of processing chemicals in the cell or something, and it actually, in the long run, makes the organism weaker. And so those ones that had that beneficial mutation and survived to live on against the penicillin, when they are put back into a regular population later on to compete against other bacteria, they end up losing out because they're weaker in the long run. So the mutation, while it was beneficial in the short run, was actually weakened the overall survival survival ability of the organism.
So it literally isn't survival of the fittest in that example, not to mention the fact that new genetic information isn't being created, isn't being pumped into the system, but in fact, over time, being lost.
Right. Mutations can take existing information and they can scramble it, they can rearrange it, they can delete it, but it can't add fundamentally new information in a way that would increase information. You could think of it like a computer program. A lot of people have compared the genetic information that's contained in DNA to a computer program, and I don't know of any computer programmers that would use random scrambling of their program as a way to kind of improve it. You can't create new information just by scrambling, rearranging, or deleting it. There has to be some kind of intelligent guiding process to direct that to you know, to create information.
Well, then with only 30 seconds here, should any of the failure of these proofs, and there are others that we could mention, should any of it come as a surprise to Christians? About 30 seconds, Pastor Schneider.
No, I really don't think it should, because science is a fallible enterprise. It's a human endeavor to understand the world that God has created. And so science, to proceed, has to be correctable. It has to be falsifiable, or, that there are theories that can be tested and examined and be found, potentially false. And if they're not, false, then we can hold on to them. But so science is always open to that kind of adjustment. And that's really why, intelligent design and creationism should be allowed into the discussion so that, the theories of science can be critiqued and evaluated and if possible, come to better ones.
Pastor Joshua Schneider is pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Kahului, Hawaii. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Deconstructing Evolution's Icons. Pastor Schneider, say hello to your parents for us. We met them a few times some years back at a remote broadcast from Michigan.
Mom and Dad.
Thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you.
When we come back, Pastor Hans Feeney joins us. We're going to talk about pastors, youth, and forgiveness. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Federal authorities recently announced arrests in a multi-state human trafficking ring. Foreign women were secretly brought across the border to function as sex slaves in the Hispanic community on the northwest side of Indianapolis. Authorities said the illegal activity had been operating for several years. An immediate question comes to mind. Was Planned Parenthood conspiring with this ring? Previous pro-life sting operations have shown Planned Parenthood staff in other states eagerly cooperating. Men posed as sex trade managers and asked for abortion and STD treatment for the underage foreign girls who worked for them. They were even given advice on how to get around parental involvement laws related to abortion. So it's fair to ask if Planned Parenthood was involved.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.